The Nigger of the Narcissus, A Tale of the Fo'c'sle. Chapter 1. Mr. Baker, chief mate of the ship Narcissus, stepped in one stride out of his lighted cabin into the darkness of the quarterdeck. Above his head, on the break of the poop, the night watchman rang a double stroke. It was 9 o'clock. Mr. Baker, speaking up to the man above him, asked, "Are all the hands aboard, Knowles?" The man limped down the ladder, then said reflectively, "Dash. I think so, sir. All our old chaps are there, and a lot of new men has come. They must be all there." "Tell the bosun to send all hands aft, one on Mr. Baker, and tell one of the youngsters to bring a good lamp here. I want to muster our crowd." The main deck was dark aft, but halfway from forward, through the open doors of the fo'c'sle, two streaks of brilliant light cut the shadow of the quiet night that lay upon the ship. A hum of voices was heard there, while port and starboard, in the illuminated doorways, silhouettes of moving men appeared for a moment, very black, without relief, like figures cut out of sheet tin. The ship was ready for sea. The carpenter had driven in the last wedge of the main hatch battens, and, throwing down his maul, had wiped his face with great deliberation, just on the stroke of 5. The decks had been swept, the windlass oiled and made ready to heave up the anchor, the big tow rope lay in long bights along one side of the main deck, with one end carried up and hung over the bows, in readiness for the tug that would come paddling and hissing noisily, hot and smoky, in the limpid, cool quietness of the early morning. The captain was ashore, where he had been engaging some new hands to make up his full crew, and, the work of the day over, the ship's officers had kept out of the way, glad of a little breathing time. Soon after dark the few liberty men and the new hands began to arrive in shore boats rowed by white-clad Asiatics, who clamored fiercely for payment before coming alongside the gangway ladder. The feverish and shrill babble of Eastern language struggled against the masterful tones of tipsy seamen, who argued against brazen claims and dishonest hopes by profane shouts. The resplendent and best-hard peace of the East was torn into squalid tatters by howls of rage and shrieks of lament raised over sums ranging from 5 annas to half a rupee, and every soul afloat in Bombay Harbor became aware that the new hands were joining the Narcissus. Gradually the distracting noise had subsided. The boats came no longer in splashing clusters of 3 or 4 together, but dropped alongside singly, in a subdued buzz of expostulation cut short by a nod a pace more. "You go to the devil." From some man staggering up the accommodation ladder a dark figure, with a long bag poised on the shoulder. In the fo'c'sle the newcomers, upright and swaying amongst corded boxes and bundles of bedding, made friends with the old hands, who sat one above another in the two tiers of bunks, gazing at their future shipmates with glances critical but friendly. The two fo'c'sle lamps were turned up high, and shed an intense hard glare, shore-going round hats were pushed far on the backs of heads, or rolled about on the deck amongst the chain cables, white collars, undone, stuck out on each side of red faces, big arms in white sleeves gesticulated, the growling voices hummed steady amongst bursts of laughter and hoarse calls. "Here, sonny, take that bunk. Don't you do it. What's your last ship?" "I know her. 3 years ago, in Puget Sound. This here berth leaks, I tell you. Come on, give us a chance to swing that chest. Did you bring a bottle, any of you short offs? Give us a bit of baccy. I know her. Her skipper drank himself to death. He was a dandy boy. Liked his lotion inside, he did. No. Hold your row, you chaps. I tell you, you came on board a hooker, where they get their money's worth out of poor Jack, bye." A little fellow, called Crike and nicknamed Belfast, abused the ship violently, romancing on principle, just to give the new hands something to think over. Archie, sitting aslant on his sea chest, kept his knees out of the way, and pushed the needle steadily through a white patch in a pair of blue trousers. Men in black jackets and stand-up collars, mixed with men barefooted, bare-armed, with colored shirts open on hairy chests, pushed against one another in the middle of the fo'c'sle. The group swayed, reeled, turning upon itself with the motion of a scrimmage, in a haze of tobacco smoke. All were speaking together, swearing at every second word. A Russian Finn, wearing a yellow shirt with pink stripes, stared upwards, dreamy-eyed, from under a mop of tumbled hair. Two young giants with smooth, baby faces, two Scandinavians helped each other to spread their bedding, silent, and smiling placidly at the tempest of good-humored and meaningless curses. Old Singleton, the oldest able seaman in the ship, sat apart on the deck right under the lamps, stripped to the waist, tattooed like a cannibal chief all over his powerful chest and enormous biceps. Between the blue and red patterns his white skin gleamed like satin, his bare back was propped against the heel of the bowsprit, and he held a book at arm's length before his big, sunburned face. With his spectacles and a venerable white beard, He resembled a learned and savage patriarch, the incarnation of barbarian wisdom serene in the blasphemous turmoil of the world. He was intensely absorbed, and as he turned the pages an expression of grave surprise would pass over his rugged features. He was reading Pelham. The popularity of Bulwer Lytton in the forecastles of southern-going ships is a wonderful and bizarre phenomenon. What ideas do his polished and so curiously insincere sentences awaken in the simple minds of the big children who people those dark and wandering places of the earth? What meaning can their rough, inexperienced souls find in the elegant verbiage of his pages? What excitement! What forgetfulness! What appeasement! Mystery! Is it the fascination of the incomprehensible? Is it the charm of the impossible? Or are those beings who exist beyond the pale of life stirred by his tales as by an enigmatical disclosure of a resplendent world that exists within the frontier of infamy and filth, within that border of dirt and hunger, of misery and dissipation, that comes down on all sides to the water's edge of the incorruptible ocean, and is the only thing they know of life, the only thing they see of surrounding land those lifelong prisoners of the sea? Mystery. Singleton, who had sailed to the southward since the age of 12, who in the last 45 years had lived, as we had calculated from his papers, no more than 40 months ashore, old Singleton, who boasted, with the mild composure of long years well spent, that generally from the day he was paid off from one ship till the day he shipped in another he seldom was in a condition to distinguish daylight, old Singleton sat unmoved in the clash of voices and cries, spelling through Pelham with slow labor, and lost in an absorption profound enough to resemble a trance. He breathed regularly. Every time he turned the book in his enormous and blackened hands the muscles of his big white arms rolled slightly under the smooth skin. Hidden by the white mustache, his lips, stained with tobacco juice that trickled down the long beard, moved in inward whisper. His bleared eyes gazed fixedly from behind the glitter of black-rimmed glasses. Opposite to him, and on a level with his face, the ship's cat sat on the barrel of the windlass in the pose of a crouching chimera, blinking its green eyes at its old friend. It seemed to meditate a leap onto the old man's lap over the bent back of the ordinary seaman who sat at Singleton's feet. Young Charlie was lean and long-necked. The ridge of his backbone made a chain of small hills under the old shirt. His face of a street boy, a face precocious, sagacious, and ironic, with deep downward folds on each side of the thin, wide mouth hung low over his bony knees. He was learning to make a lanyard knot with a bit of an old rope. Small drops of perspiration stood out on his bulging forehead. He sniffed strongly from time to time, glancing out of the corners of his restless eyes at the old seaman, who took no notice of the puzzled youngster muttering at his work. The noise increased. Little Belfast seemed, in the heavy heat of the forecastle, to boil with facetious fury. His eyes danced, in the crimson of his face, comical as a mask, the mouth yawned black, with strange grimaces. Facing him, a half-undressed man held his sides, and, throwing his head back, laughed with wet eyelashes. Others stared with amazed eyes. Men sitting doubled up in the upper bunks smoked short pipes, swinging bare brown feet above the heads of those who, sprawling below on sea chests, listened, smiling stupidly or scornfully. Over the white rims of berths stuck out heads with blinking eyes, but the bodies were lost in the gloom of those places, that resembled narrow niches for coffins in a whitewashed and lighted mortuary. Voices buzzed louder. Archie, with compressed lips, drew himself in, seemed to shrink into a smaller space, and sewed steadily, industrious and dumb. Belfast shrieked like an inspired dervish, dash, so I sees to him, boys, sees I, beggin' your pardon, sore, sees I to that second mate of that steamer beggin' your RR pardon, sore, the Board of Trade must have been drunk when they granted you your certificate. What do you say, you? Sees he, coming at me like a mad bull. All in his white clothes, and I up with my tar pot and capsizes it all over his blamed lovely face and his lovely jacket. Take that. Sees I am a sailor, anyhow, you nosing, skipper licking, useless, superfluous bridge stanchion, you. That's the kind of man I am. Shouts I. You should have seen him skip, boys. Drowned, blind with tar, he was. So. Don't ye believe him. He never upset no tar, I was there. Shouted somebody. The two Norwegians sat on a chest side by side, alike and placid, resembling a pair of love birds on a perch, and with round eyes stared innocently, but the Russian Finn, in the racket of explosive shouts and rolling laughter, remained motionless, limp and dull, like a deaf man without a backbone. Near him Archie smiled at his needle. A broad-chested, slow-eyed newcomer spoke deliberately to Belfast during an exhausted lull in the noise. I wonder any of the mates here are alive yet with such a chap as you on board. I conclude they ain't that bad now, if you had the taming of them, sonny. Not bad. Not bad. screamed Belfast. If it wasn't for us sticking together. Not bad. They ain't never bad when they ain't got a chance, bless their black hearts. He foamed, whirling his arms, then suddenly grinned and, taking a tablet of black tobacco out of his pocket, bit a piece off with a funny show of ferocity. Another new hand, a man with shifty eyes and a yellow hatchet face, who had been listening open-mouthed in the shadow of the midship locker, observed in a squeaky voice, "Well, it's a homeward trip, anyhow. Bad or good, I can do it on my head as long as I get home. And I can look after my rights. I will show 'em." All the heads turned towards him. Only the ordinary seaman and the cat took no notice. He stood with arms akimbo, a little fellow with white eyelashes. He looked as if he had known all the degradations and all the furies. He looked as if he had been cuffed, kicked, rolled in the mud. He looked as if he had been scratched, spat upon, pelted with unmentionable filth. And he smiled with a sense of security at the faces around. His ears were bending down under the weight of his battered felt hat. The torn tails of his black coat flapped in fringes about the calves of his legs. He unbuttoned the only two buttons that remained, and everyone saw that he had no shirt under it. It was his deserved misfortune that those rags which nobody could possibly be supposed to own looked on him as if they had been stolen. His neck was long and thin, his eyelids were red, rare hairs hung about his jaws, his shoulders were peaked and drooped like the broken wings of a bird, all his left side was caked with mud which showed that he had lately slept in a wet ditch. He had saved his inefficient carcass from violent destruction by running away from an American ship where, in a moment of forgetful folly, he had dared to engage himself, and he had knocked about for a fortnight ashore in the native quarter, cadging for drinks, starving, sleeping on rubbish heaps, wandering in sunshine, a startling visitor from a world of nightmares. He stood repulsive and smiling in the sudden silence. This clean white forecastle was his refuge, the place where he could be lazy, where he could wallow, and lie and eat and curse the food he ate, where he could display his talents for shirking work, for cheating, for cadging, where he could find surely someone to wheedle and someone to bully, and where he would be paid for doing all this. They all knew him. Is there a spot on earth where such a man is unknown, an ominous survival testifying to the eternal fitness of lies and impudence? A taciturn long-armed shellback, with hooked fingers, who had been lying on his back smoking, turned in his bed to examine him dispassionately, then, over his head, sent a long jet of clear saliva towards the door. They all knew him. He was the man that cannot steer, that cannot splice, that dodges the work on dark nights, that, aloft, holds on frantically with both arms and legs, and swears at the wind, the sleet, the darkness, the man who curses the sea while others work. The man who is the last out and the first in when all hands are called. The man who can't do most things and won't do the rest. The pet of philanthropists and self-seeking landlubbers. The sympathetic and deserving creature that knows all about his rights, but knows nothing of courage, of endurance, and of the unexpressed faith, of the unspoken loyalty that knits together a ship's company. The independent offspring of the ignoble freedom of the slums, full of disdain and hate for the austere servitude of the sea. Someone cried at him, "What's your name, Donkin?" he said, looking round with cheerful effrontery, "What are you?" asked another voice, "Why, a sailor like you, old man," he replied, in a tone that meant to be hearty but was impudent. "Blam if you don't look a blamed sight worse than a broken down fireman," was the comment and a convinced mutter. Charlie lifted his head and piped in a cheeky voice, "He is a man and a sailor," then wiping his nose with the back of his hand bent down industriously over his bit of rope. A few laughed. Others stared doubtfully. The ragged newcomer was indignant. "That's a fine way to welcome a chap into a fo'sle," he snarled. "Are you men or a lot of artless cannibals? Don't take your shirt off for a word, shipmate," called out Belfast, jumping up in front, fiery, menacing, and friendly at the same time. "Is that air bloke blind?" asked the indomitable scarecrow, looking right and left with affected surprise. "Can thee see I haven't got no shirt?" He held both his arms out crosswise and shook the rags that hung over his bones with dramatic effect. "'Cause why?" he continued very loud. "The bloody Yankees been trying to jump my guts out 'cause I stood up for my rights like a good 'un. I am an Englishman, I am. They set upon me and I had to run. That's why. Ain't you're never seed a man 'ard up? Yeah. What kind of blame ship is this? I'm dead broke. I haven't got nothing. No bag, no bed, no blanket, no shirt, not a bloomin' rag but what I stand in. But I had the art to stand up again them Yankees. Has any of you art enough to spare a pair of old pants for a chum?" He knew how to conquer the naive instincts of that crowd. In a moment they gave him their compassion, jocularly, contemptuously, or surlily, and at first it took the shape of a blanket thrown at him as he stood there with the white skin of his limbs showing his human kinship through the black fantasy of his rags. Then a pair of old shoes fell at his muddy feet. With a cry, from under, a rolled-up pair of canvas trousers, heavy with tar stains, struck him on the shoulder. The gust of their benevolence sent a wave of sentimental pity through their doubting hearts. They were touched by their own readiness to alleviate a shipmate's misery. Voices cried, "We will fit you out, old man." Murmurs, "Never seed seach a hard case. Poor beggar. I've got an old singlet. Will that be of any use to you? Ticket, matey." Those friendly murmurs filled the forecastle. He pawed around with his naked foot, gathering the things in a heap and looked about for more. Unemotional Archie perfunctorily contributed to the pile an old cloth cap with the peak torn off. Old Singleton, lost in the serene regions of fiction, read on unheeding. Charlie, pitiless with the wisdom of youth, squeaked, "If you want brass buttons for your new uniforms, I've got two for you." The filthy object of universal charity shook his fist at the youngster. "I'll make you keep this air fossil clean, young feller," he snarled viciously. "Never you fear. I will learn you to be civil to an able seaman, you ignorant ass." He glared harmfully, but saw Singleton shut his book, and his little beady eyes began to roam from berth to berth. "Take that bunk by the door there, it's pretty fair," suggested Belfast. So advised, he gathered the gifts at his feet, pressed them in a bundle against his breast, then looked cautiously at the Russian Finn, who stood on one side with an unconscious gaze, contemplating, perhaps, one of those weird visions that haunt the men of his race. "Get out of my road, Dutchie," said the victim of Yankee brutality. The Finn did not move, did not hear. "Get out, blast ye," shouted the other, shoving him aside with his elbow. "Get out, you blank deaf and dumb fool. Get out." The man staggered, recovered himself, and gazed at the speaker in silence. "Those damned foreigners should be kept under," opined the amiable donk into the forecastle. "If you don't teach them their place, they put on you like anything." He flung all his worldly possessions into the empty bed place, gauged with another shrewd look the risks of the proceeding, then leapt up to the Finn, who stood pensive and dull. "I'll teach you to swell around," he yelled. "I'll plug your eyes for you, you blooming squarehead." Most of the men were now in their bunks and the two had the forecastle cleared to themselves. The development of the destitute Duncan aroused interest. He danced all in tatters before the amazed Finn, squaring from a distance at the heavy, unmoved face. One or two men cried encouragingly, "Go it, Whitechapel," settling themselves luxuriously in their beds to survey the fight. Others shouted, "Shut your row. Go and put your head in a bag." The hubbub was recommencing. Suddenly many heavy blows struck with a handspike on the deck above boomed like discharges of small cannon through the forecastle. Then the bosun's voice rose outside the door with an authoritative note in its drawl, "Do you hear, below there? Lay aft. Lay aft to muster all hands." There was a moment of surprised stillness. Then the forecastle floor disappeared under men whose bare feet flopped on the planks as they sprang clear out of their berths. Caps were rooted for amongst tumbled blankets. Some, yawning, buttoned waistbands. Half-smoked pipes were knocked hurriedly against woodwork and stuffed under pillows. Voices growled, "What's up? Is there no rest for us?" Duncan yelped, "If that's the way of this ship, we'll have to change all that. You leave me alone. I will soon." None of the crowd noticed him. They were lurching in twos and threes through the doors, after the manner of merchant jacks who cannot go out of a door fairly, like mere landsmen. The votary of change followed them. Singleton, struggling into his jacket, came last, tall and fatherly, bearing high his head of a weather-beaten sage on the body of an old athlete. Only Charlie remained alone in the white glare of the empty place, sitting between the two rows of iron links that stretched into the narrow gloom forward. He pulled hard at the strands in a hurried endeavor to finish his knot. Suddenly he started up, flung the rope at the cat, and skipped after the black tom, which went off leaping sedately over chain compressors, with its tail carried stiff and upright, like a small flagpole. Outside the glare of the steaming forecastle, the serene purity of the night enveloped the seaman with its soothing breath, with its tepid breath flowing under the stars that hung countless above the mastheads in a thin cloud of luminous dust. On the town side, the blackness of the water was streaked with trails of light which undulated gently on slight ripples, similar to filaments that float rooted to the shore. Rows of other lights stood away in straight lines as if drawn up on parade between towering buildings, but on the other side of the harbor somber hills arched high their black spines, on which, here and there, the point of a star resembled a spark fallen from the sky. Far off, Baikal away, the electric lamps at the dock gates shone on the end of lofty standards with a glow blinding and frigid like captive ghosts of some evil moons. Scattered all over the dark polish of the roadstead, The ships at anchor floated in perfect stillness under the feeble gleam of their riding lights, looming up, opaque and bulky, like strange and monumental structures abandoned by men to an everlasting repose. Before the cabin door, Mr. Baker was mustering the crew. As they stumbled and lurched along past the mainmast, they could see aft his round, broad face with a white paper before it, and beside his shoulder the sleepy head, with dropped eyelids, of the boy, who held, suspended at the end of his raised arm, the luminous globe of a lamp. Even before the shuffle of naked souls had ceased along the decks, the mate began to call over the names. He called distinctly in a serious tone befitting this roll call to unquiet loneliness, to inglorious and obscure struggle, or to the more trying endurance of small privations and wearisome duties. As the chief mate read out a name, one of the men would answer, "Yes, sir," or "Here," and, detaching himself from the shadowy mob of heads visible above the blackness of starboard bulwarks, would step barefooted into the circle of light, and in two noiseless strides pass into the shadows on the port side of the quarterdeck. They answered in divers tones, in thick mutters, in clear, ringing voices, and some, as if the whole thing had been an outrage on their feelings, used an injured intonation, for discipline is not ceremonious in merchant ships, where the sense of hierarchy is weak, and where all feel themselves equal before the unconcerned immensity of the sea and the exacting appeal of the work. Mr. Baker read on steadily, "Hanson Campbell Smith Waymabo. Now, then, Waymabo. Why don't you answer? Always got to call your name twice." The Finn emitted at last an uncouth grunt, and, stepping out, passed through the patch of light, weird and gaudy, with the face of a man marching through a dream. The mate went on faster, "Craig Singleton Duncan. Oh Lord!" he involuntarily ejaculated as the incredibly dilapidated figure appeared in the light. It stopped, it uncovered pale gums and long, upper teeth in a malevolent grin. "Is there anything wrong with me, Mr. Mate?" it asked, with a flavor of insolence in the forced simplicity of its tone. On both sides of the deck subdued titters were heard, "That'll do. Go over," growled Mr. Baker, fixing the new hand with steady blue eyes. And Duncan vanished suddenly out of the light into the dark group of mustered men, to be slapped on the back and to hear flattering whispers, "He ain't afeard, he'll give sport to him, see if he don't. Riggler Punch and Judy show. Did ye see the mate start at him? Well, Dama, if I ever." The last man had gone over, and there was a moment of silence while the mate peered at his list. 16, 17, he muttered. "I am one hand short, bosun," he said aloud. The big West countryman at his elbow, swarthy and bearded like a gigantic Spaniard, said in a rumbling bass, "There's no one left forward, sir. I had a look round. He ain't aboard, but he may turn up before daylight." "Eh? He may or he may not," commented the mate, "can't make out that last name. It's all a smudge. That will do, men. Go below." The distinct and motionless group stirred, broke up, began to move forward. "Wait!" cried a deep, ringing voice. All stood still. Mr. Baker, who had turned away yawning, spun round open-mouthed. At last, furious, he blurted out, "What's this? Who said wait? What?" But he saw a tall figure standing on the rail. It came down and pushed through the crowd, marching with a heavy tread towards the light on the quarterdeck. Then again the sonorous voice said with insistence, "Wait." The lamplight lit up the man's body. He was tall. His head was away up in the shadows of lifeboats that stood on skids above the deck. The whites of his eyes and his teeth gleamed distinctly, but the face was indistinguishable. His hands were big and seemed gloved. Mr. Baker advanced intrepidly. "Who are you? How dare you?" he began. The boy, amazed like the rest, raised the light to the man's face. It was black. A surprised hum, a faint hum that sounded like the suppressed mutter of the word nigger, ran along the deck and escaped out into the night. The nigger seemed not to hear. He balanced himself where he stood in a swagger that marked time. After a moment he said calmly, "My name is Wait James Wait." "Oh," said Mr. Baker. Then, after a few seconds of smoldering silence, his temper blazed out. "Ah. Your name is Wait. What of that? What do you want? What do you mean, coming shouting here?" The nigger was calm, cool, towering, superb. The men had approached and stood behind him in a body. He overtopped the tallest by half a head. He said, "I belong to the ship." He enunciated distinctly, with soft precision. The deep, rolling tones of his voice filled the deck without effort. He was naturally scornful, unaffectedly condescending, as if from his height of 6'3" he had surveyed all the vastness of human folly and had made up his mind not to be too hard on it. He went on, "The captain shipped me this morning. I couldn't get aboard sooner. I saw you all aft as I came up the ladder, and could see directly you were mustering the crew. Naturally I called out my name. I thought you had it on your list, and would understand. You misapprehended. He stopped short. The folly around him was confounded. He was right as ever, and as ever ready to forgive. The disdainful tones had ceased, and, breathing heavily, he stood still, surrounded by all these white men. He held his head up in the glare of the lamp A had vigorously modeled into deep shadows and shining lights A had powerful and misshapen with a tormented and flattened face, a face pathetic and brutal, the tragic, the mysterious, the repulsive mask of a nigger soul. Mr. Baker, recovering his composure, looked at the paper close. Oh, yes, that's so. All right, wait. Take your gear forward, he said. Suddenly the nigger's eyes rolled wildly, became all whites. He put his hand to his side and coughed twice, a cough metallic, hollow, and tremendously loud. It resounded like two explosions in a vault, the dome of the sky rang to it, and the iron plates of the ship's bulwarks seemed to vibrate in unison. Then he marched off forward with the others. The officers lingering by the cabin door could hear him say, "Won't some of you chaps lend a hand with my dunnage? I've got a chest and a bag." The words, spoken sonorously, with an even intonation, were heard all over the ship, and the question was put in a manner that made refusal impossible. The short, quick shuffle of men carrying something heavy went away forward, but the tall figure of the nigger lingered by the main hatch in a knot of smaller shapes. Again he was heard asking, "Is your cook a colored gentleman?" Then a disappointed and disapproving "Ah, H.M.," was his comment upon the information that the cook happened to be a mere white man. Yet, as they went all together towards the forecastle, he condescended to put his head through the galley door and boom out inside a magnificent "Good evening, doctor." That made all the saucepans ring. In the dim light the cook dozed on the coal locker in front of the captain's supper. He jumped up as if he had been cut with a whip, and dashed wildly on deck to see the backs of several men going away laughing. Afterwards, when talking about that voyage, he used to say, "The poor fellow had scared me. I thought I had seen the devil." The cook had been 7 years in the ship with the same captain. He was a serious-minded man with a wife and three children, whose society he enjoyed on an average 1 month out of 12. When on shore he took his family to church twice every Sunday. At sea he went to sleep every evening with his lamp turned up full, a pipe in his mouth, and an open Bible in his hand. Someone had always to go during the night to put out the light, take the book from his hand, and the pipe from between his teeth. For Belfast used to say, irritated and complaining some night, "You stupid cookie, you'll swallow your old clay, and we will have no cook. Ah, sonny, I am ready for my maker's call. Wish you all were," the other would answer with a benign serenity that was altogether imbecile and touching. Belfast outside the galley door danced with vexation. "You holy fool. I don't want you to die," he howled, looking up with furious, quivering face and tender eyes. "What's the hurry? You blessed wooden-headed old heretic, the divil will have you soon enough. Think of us. Of us. Of us." And he would go away, stamping, spitting aside, disgusted and worried, while the other, stepping out, saucepan in hand, hot, begrimed and placid, watched with a superior, cocksure smile the back of his queer little man reeling in a rage. They were great friends. Mr. Baker, lounging over the after hatch, sniffed the humid night in the company of the second mate. "Those West India niggers run fine and large, some of them. Ook. Don't they? A fine, big man that, Mr. Creighton. Feel him on a rope. Hey? Ook. I will take him into my watch, I think." The second mate, a fair, gentlemanly young fellow, with a resolute face and a splendid physique, observed quietly that it was just about what he expected. There could be felt in his tone some slight bitterness which Mr. Baker very kindly set himself to argue away. "Come, come, young man," he said, grunting between the words. "Come. Don't be too greedy. You had that big fin in your watch all the voyage. I will do what's fair. You may have those two young Scandinavians and I. Ook. I get the nigger, and we'll take that. Ook. That cheeky costermonger chap in a black frock coat. I'll make him. Ook. Make him toe the mark, or my. Ook. Name isn't Baker. Ook. Ook. Ook." He grunted thrice ferociously. He had that trick of grunting so between his words and at the end of sentences. It was a fine, effective grunt that went well with his menacing utterance, with his heavy, bull-necked frame, his jerky, rolling gait, with his big, seamed face, his steady eyes, and sardonic mouth. But its effect had been long ago discounted by the men. They liked him, Belfast, who was a favorite, and knew it mimicked him, not quite behind his back. Charlie but with greater caution imitated his rolling gait. Some of his sayings became established, daily quotations in the forecastle. Popularity can go no farther. Besides, all hands were ready to admit that on a fitting occasion the mate could jump down a fellow's throat in a regular Western Ocean style. Now he was giving his last orders. Ook. You, Knowles. Call all hands at 4. I want. Ook. To heave short before the tug comes. Look out for the captain. I am going to lie down in my clothes. Ook. Call me when you see the boat coming. Ook. Ook. The old man is sure to have something to say when he gets aboard, he remarked to Creighton. Well, good night. Ook. A long day before us tomorrow. Ook. Better turn in now. Ook. Ook. Upon the dark deck a band of light flashed, then a door slammed, and Mr. Baker was gone into his neat cabin. Young Creighton stood leaning over the rail, and looked dreamily into the night of the east. And he saw in it a long country lane, a lane of waving leaves and dancing sunshine. He saw stirring boughs of old trees outspread, and framing in their arch the tender, the caressing blueness of an English sky. And through the arch a girl in a light dress, smiling under a sunshade, seemed to be stepping out of the tender sky. At the other end of the ship the forecastle, with only one lamp burning now, was going to sleep in a dim emptiness traversed by loud breathings, by sudden short sighs. The double row of berths yawned black, like graves tenanted by uneasy corpses. Here and there a curtain of gaudy chintz, half drawn, marked the resting place of a sybarite. A leg hung over the edge very white and lifeless. An arm stuck straight out with a dark palm turned up, and thick fingers half closed. Two light snores, that did not synchronize, quarreled in funny dialogue. Singled and stripped again the old man suffered much from prickly heat stood cooling his back in the doorway, with his arms crossed on his barren adorned chest. His head touched the beam of the deck above. The nigger, half undressed, was busy casting adrift the lashing of his box, and spreading his bedding in an upper berth. He moved about in his socks, tall and noiseless, with a pair of braces beating about his calves. Amongst the shadows of stanchions and bowsprit, Duncan munched a piece of hard ship's bread, sitting on the deck with upturned feet and restless eyes, he held the biscuit up before his mouth in the whole fist and snapped his jaws at it with a raging face. Crumbs fell between his outspread legs. Then he got up. "Where's our water cask?" he asked in a contained voice. Singleton, without a word, pointed with a big hand that held a short smoldering pipe. Duncan bent over the cask, drank out of it in, splashing the water, turned round and noticed the nigger looking at him over the shoulder with calm loftiness. He moved up sideways. "There's a blooming supper for a man," he whispered bitterly. "My dorget omi wouldn't have it. It's fit anew for you and me. Air's a big ship's fo'sle. Not a blooming scrap of meat in the kids. I've looked in all the lockers." The nigger stared like a man addressed unexpectedly in a foreign language. Duncan changed his tone. "Give us a bit of baccy, mate," he breathed out confidentially. "I haven't had smoke or chew for the last month. I am rampin' mad for it. Come on, old man." "Don't be familiar," said the nigger. Duncan started and sat down on a chest nearby, out of sheer surprise. "We haven't kept pigs together," continued James Wade in a deep undertone. "Here's your tobacco." Then, after a pause, he inquired, "What ship?" "Golden State," muttered Duncan indistinctly, biting the tobacco. The nigger whistled low. "Ran?" he said curtly. Duncan nodded, one of his cheeks bulged out. "In course I ran," he mumbled. "They booted the life out of one Dago chap on the passage air, then started on me. I cleared out air, left your dunnage behind." "Yes, dunnage and money," answered Duncan, raising his voice a little. "I got nothing. No clothes, no bed. A bandy-legged little Irish chap here has give me a blanket. Think I'll go and sleep in the fore topmast staysail tonight." He went on deck trailing behind his back a corner of the blanket. Singleton, without a glance, moved slightly aside to let him pass. The nigger put away his short togs and sat in clean working clothes on his box, one arm stretched over his knees. After staring at Singleton for some time he asked without emphasis, "What kind of ship is this? Pretty fair? Eh?" Singleton didn't stir. A long while after he said, with unmoved face, "Ship. Ships are all right. It is the men in them." He went on smoking in the profound silence. The wisdom of half a century spent in listening to the thunder of the waves had spoken unconsciously through his old lips. The cat purred on the windlass. Then James Wade had a fit of roaring, rattling cough, that shook him, tossed him like a hurricane, and flung him panting with staring eyes headlong on his sea chest. Several men woke up. One said sleepily out of his bunk, "Struth. What a blamed row, I have a cold on my chest, gasped Wait, cold. You call it, grumbled the man, should think 'twas something more, oh. You think so, said the nigger upright and loftily scornful again. He climbed into his berth and began coughing persistently while he put his head out to glare all round the forecastle. There was no further protest. He fell back on the pillow, and could be heard there wheezing regularly like a man oppressed in his sleep. Singleton stood at the door with his face to the light and his back to the darkness. And alone in the dim emptiness of the sleeping forecastle he appeared bigger, colossal, very old, old as Father Time himself, who should have come there into this place as quiet as a sepulchre to contemplate with patient eyes the short victory of sleep, the consoler. Yet he was only a child of time, a lonely relic of a devoured and forgotten generation. He stood, still strong, as ever unthinking, a ready man with a vast empty past and with no future, with his childlike impulses and his man's passions already dead within his tattooed breast. The men who could understand his silence were gone, those men who knew how to exist beyond the pale of life and within sight of eternity. They had been strong, as those are strong who know neither doubts nor hopes. They had been impatient and enduring, turbulent and devoted, unruly and faithful. Well-meaning people had tried to represent those men as whining over every mouthful of their food, as going about their work in fear of their lives. But in truth they had been men who knew toil, privation, violence, debauchery but knew not fear, and had no desire of spite in their hearts. Men hard to manage, but easy to inspire, voiceless men but men enough to scorn in their hearts the sentimental voices that bewailed the hardness of their fate. It was a fate unique in their own. The capacity to bear it appeared to them the privilege of the chosen. Their generation lived inarticulate and indispensable, without knowing the sweetness of affections or the refuge of a home, and died free from the dark menace of a narrow grave. They were the everlasting children of the mysterious sea. Their successors are the grown-up children of a discontented earth. They are less naughty, but less innocent, less profane, but perhaps also less believing, and if they have learned how to speak they have also learned how to whine. But the others were strong and mute. They were effaced, bowed and enduring, like stone caryatides that hold up in the night the lighted halls of a resplendent and glorious edifice. They are gone now and it does not matter. The sea and the earth are unfaithful to their children, a truth, a faith, a generation of men goes and is forgotten, and it does not matter. Except, perhaps, to the few of those who believed the truth, confessed the faith or loved the men. A breeze was coming. The ship that had been lying tied rode swung to a heavier puff, and suddenly the slack of the chain cable between the windlass and the hawse pipe clinked, slipped forward an inch, and rose gently off the deck with a startling suggestion as of unsuspected life that had been lurking stealthily in the iron. In the hawse pipe the grinding link sent through the ship a sound like a low groan of a man sighing under a burden. The strain came on the windlass, the chain tautened like a string, vibrated and the handle of the screw brake moved in slight jerks. Singleton stepped forward. Till then he had been standing meditative and unthinking, reposeful and hopeless, with a face grim and blank, a 60-year-old child of the mysterious sea. The thoughts of all his lifetime could have been expressed in 6 words, but the stir of those things that were as much part of his existence as his beating heart called up a gleam of alert understanding upon the sternness of his aged face. The flame of the lamp swayed, and the old man, with knitted and bushy eyebrows, stood over the break, watchful and motionless in the wild saraband of dancing shadows. Then the ship, obedient to the call of her anchor, forged ahead slightly and eased the strain. The cable relieved, hung down, and after swaying imperceptibly to and fro dropped with a loud tap on the hardwood planks. Singleton seized the high lever, and, by a violent throw forward of his body, wrung out another half-turn from the brake. He recovered himself, breathed largely, and remained for a while glaring down at the powerful and compact engine that squatted on the deck at his feet like some quiet monster, a creature amazing and tame. You. Hold. He growled at it masterfully in the inkle tangle of his white beard. Chapter 2. Next morning, at daylight, the Narcissus went to sea. A slight haze blurred the horizon. Outside the harbor the measureless expanse of smooth water lay sparkling like a floor of jewels, and as empty as the sky. The short black tug gave a pluck to windward, in the usual way, then let go the rope, and hovered for a moment on the quarter with her engine stopped, while the slim, long hull of the ship moved ahead slowly under lower topsails. The loose upper canvas blew out in the breeze with soft round contours, resembling small white clouds snared in the maze of ropes. Then the sheets were hauled home, the yards hoisted, and the ship became a high and lonely pyramid, gliding, all shining and white, through the sunlit mist. The tug turned short round and went away towards the land. 26 pairs of eyes watched her low broad stern crawling languidly over the smooth swell between the 2 paddle wheels that turned fast, beating the water with fierce hurry. She resembled an enormous and aquatic black beetle, surprised by the light, overwhelmed by the sunshine, trying to escape with ineffectual effort into the distant gloom of the land. She left a lingering smudge of smoke on the sky, and two vanishing trails of foam on the water. On the place where she had stopped, a round black patch of soot remained, undulating on the swell, an unclean mark of the creature's rest. The Narcissus, left alone, heading south, seemed to stand resplendent and still upon the restless sea, under the moving sun. Flakes of foam swept past her sides, the water struck her with flashing blows, the land glided away slowly fading, a few birds screamed on motionless wings over the swaying mastheads. But soon the land disappeared, the birds went away, and to the west the pointed sail of an Arab dhow running for Bombay, rose triangular and upright above the sharp edge of the horizon, lingered and vanished like an illusion. Then the ship's wake, long and straight, stretched itself out through a day of immense solitude. The setting sun, burning on the level of the water, flamed crimson below the blackness of heavy rain clouds. The sunset squall, coming up from behind, dissolved itself into the short deluge of a hissing shower. It left the ship glistening from trucks to waterline, and with darkened sails. She ran easily before a fair monsoon, with her decks cleared for the night, and, moving along with her, was heard the sustained and monotonous swishing of the waves, mingled with the low whispers of men mustered aft for the setting of watches, the short plaint of some block aloft, or, now and then, a loud sigh of wind. Mr. Baker, coming out of his cabin, called out the first name sharply before closing the door behind him. He was going to take charge of the deck. On the homeward trip, according to an old custom of the sea, the chief officer takes the first night watch from 8 till midnight. So Mr. Baker, after he had heard the last "Yes, sir," said moodily, "Relieve the wheel and look out," and climbed with heavy feet the poop ladder to windward. Soon after, Mr. Creighton came down, whistling softly, and went into the cabin. On the doorstep the steward lounged, in slippers, meditative, and with his shirt